You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 255 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
And home of a lot of pass rushers. We'll talk about that later in this podcast. But let's get right into it, starting with this week's beer, going back to our friends Fremont Brewery as part of their brewery-only release. We've got here the Hella Good Helles Lager, which, according to their website, is made with Franzen Pilsner malts with German Hallertau Mittelfra hops.
All right. Reminds me of Ziggy's Hofbräu. Let's go.
Well, we have a basketball heavy, but particularly a women's basketball heavy series of toasts this week, starting with congratulations to a couple of former Storm players now in coaching. First off, to friend of the pod, Adia Barnes, leading her alma mater, Arizona, to the Final Four for the first time in program history. One of two Pac-12 teams in the women's Final Four.
Did I call that?
Arizona?
Yeah.
I doubt it. There were three people I saw who had perfect Final Fours in our tournament challenge.
Really?
Yeah. Arizona was the one non-number one seed. They were the only upset of that group. But obviously a sentimental favorite for Storm fans. And just awesome to see Adia and also Salvo Coppa, who is a volunteer assistant with the Storm. He actually coached at my alma mater high school team when he was in Seattle. Yeah.
Wait, who's this?
It's her husband, who's an assistant coach on the team.
Coached at Mariner High School?
Yeah, when he first came over here after the he had been a coach in Italy as well. That's how they met. So then also to Katie Geralds, who was named associate head coach at her alma mater, Purdue, where she'll succeed Shannon Versip as head coach in 2022 after an outstanding 8-year run at NAIA Marion University, where Geralds' team won a pair of national championships in 2016 and 2017. So former Storm players making good as coaches.
There we go.
Then also is for that other Pac-12 team in the Women's Final Four, to Bellevue High School product Anna Wilson for helping her Stanford team to the Final Four for the 14th time in program history. Wilson, whose brother Russell played at Wisconsin and North Carolina State and now plays professionally for the Seattle Seahawks, has become a full-time starter as a fifth-year senior, averaging 24 minutes per game and shooting 43% from three-point range. The top overall seed, the Cardinal going for their first title since 1992 after losing the title game in both 2008 and 2010.
Wow. For the record, I did call Arizona. I was going to say, like if a Pac-12 team made it, I mean, I had 75% Pac-12 teams in the Final Four.
I mean, still not as good as Bill Walton's Final Four.
Close.
You didn't manage to get five in there. I suppose we have to say congrats to Gonzaga for reaching the Final Four for the second time in program history. I know you're upset about it, but I like watching this Gonzaga team play. I hope they pull off the perfect season. You have no comment on this? Just in finally taking the approach, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
I'm all positivity on this podcast, by the way. Everything.
Pivoted to positivity.
Mariners hot take, Seahawks offseason. Let's go. Pivot to good vibes only on the Pelton Cast 2021. We waited until April to get to the good vibes only portion of 2021, but here we go.
Okay, so updating on our tournament challenge bracket pools on the men's side, it's Z Fakata leading the way with 820 points in the 99.5th percentile nationally.
Wow.
He has Gonzaga is his champion, beating Baylor in the final. So both of those possibilities still alive. A few other potential winners. I guess we've got a Houston, we've got a Baylor, not too far back. So if those two teams win the national championship, those entries could surpass him. Sadly, your entry, which is tied for second, lost national champion Michigan earlier tonight.
I'm good with that.
You're just excited for the Pac-12. Can I tell you what your your excitement about the Pac-12 success in this NCAA tournament makes me think of every time.
What?
It's Mina tweeting a couple weeks ago about how rooting for her tournament in her conference in the NCAA tournament is like the photo of Rob Lowe at the NFC Championship game wearing an NFL hat. An iconic, blessed photo.
Is the Pac-12 Mina's conference in this scenario?
I think so. Based on the fact that Jeff Schwartz, Oregon alum Jeff Schwartz, took it upon himself to make fun of UW for having only won 5 games this season. I assume that's where it was going.
That's not fair. When you adjust for difficulty of schedule, they won like 20 games.
I mean, they keep moving up. I have not checked after the UCLA victory whether they climbed at all any more in the KenPom ranking. Solidly up to number 130 now.
UW is close to being a tournament snub. By the end of this tournament, they will be a tournament snub.
Again, they ended the regular season or entering their final regular season or their final Pac-12 conference game, I should say. They did end the regular season number 176 in the KenPom rankings. They are now 130.
That's
so
incredible.
If UCLA wins the national championship, could crack the top 120. It's possible.
There we go.
Someone tell all the players who have put their names in the transfer portal.
I also just like UCLA too, even beyond that. Like if this was Oregon or, I don't know, Arizona, I think it would have felt a little bit different. But UCLA is a school that I generally cheer for.
It's not as bad as the last time that the UW men's basketball program was in complete chaos after they had fired Lorenzo Romar and both Oregon and Gonzaga made the Final Four. That was a rough year.
I think that was Jeff Schwartz talking to Mina, where he was like, our rival is Washington. He was like, I'll cheer for Oregon State. I won't cheer for Washington. And you know what? I really appreciated being considered Oregon's rival.
Yes, it was generous. We could agree
on that
one.
I was like, that's great. We feel the same way, so that's really cool.
Okay, on the women's side, JJ Tavitar leads the bracket pool, has UConn over South Carolina in the final. So if Stanford, the number one overall seed, as I mentioned, goes on to win, a few possibilities depending on what happens with the Final Four semifinals and the final. Sadly, I cannot win since Noah Cohen is ahead of me and also has Stanford beating UConn in the final.
How am I faring there? Not very good?
Not nearly as well. Let me tell you, both of these brackets are quite good. We're ranked number 1099 on the men's side out of presumably a lot of groups.
And we, as a group?
Yeah, like the average score in our group in the top 1,000 on the women's side.
Wow, there you go. Crack the top 1,000. Do you think that it's because the Pac-12 has fared very well in both of these tournaments?
That probably and does not hurt.
Generally speaking, we're probably going to overvalue the Pac-12.
And Gonzaga, yeah, any team on the West Coast.
That's really funny. Crack the top 1,000. We're like UW basketball, moving on up, crack the top 1,000.
Okay, lastly, on a sadder women's basketball note, it's a get well soon message for former Storm forward Alicia Clark. Her new team, the Washington Mystics, announced Monday that Clark will miss the 2021 WNBA season after undergoing surgery to repair a Lisfranc fracture of her right foot. So looking forward to seeing her back out on the court in 2022, but definitely disappointing that Alicia will not be playing next season. With those toasts in the book, should we talk about food?
Absolutely, we should.
Our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, so far the epicenter. The place we keep going back to, Pioneer Square, all places. So this past week, after pivoting because it was not, now you determined it was not nice enough weather for us to get June Baby.
It's true. I want to put the June Baby fried chicken in the best possible light. And I can't describe to you just how different that chicken will taste if it is 45 degrees and pouring rain, or if it is 70 degrees and sunny on a Sunday. I'm just being honest with you. Like, the best chicken is going to be eaten in the best light. It's going to be eaten the freshest, and it's going to be eaten in the best emotional situation.
Do you have a sense of how many points that would be worth in terms of a rating?
It could be worth a lot. look, if this was a search happening over the summer, I'd just adjust every point value up 5. But, but we wanted to go into this particular meal Sunday morning It wasn't nice out necessarily. It was kind of a gloomy day. But I sat eating this particular meal from Pioneer Square D&E, having their fried chicken. I got it. I picked it up. It was hot and fresh. I sat in my car, had the Den of Thieves rewatchables on, and I thought to myself, there are perfect moments.
Wow. All right, well, don't spoil how good this was, your review here. Let's talk quickly about Pioneer Square D&E, which is owned by the husband and wife duo of Jonathan Fleming and Libby Aker. Opened in 2018, and a somewhat more diverse menu, I think, going into the pandemic, has refocused the menu on fried chicken during the course of the past year because it travels so well.
That is really funny. Wait, because, okay, finish what you're going to say, because I actually have a take based upon this.
So previously, the chicken sandwich was a favorite on their menu, which helps explain, I think, why they wanted to really pivot to fried chicken. And they're occasionally going, sometimes you'll see now D&E's Famous Fried Chicken is a name for this location.
Interesting. Okay, so the traveling well argument for chicken. I think that if I knew anything about cars, I would give an incredible comparison for this. I think that chicken travels well and it has a very good long tail when traveling. Once it reaches 20 minutes past getting it, it's not all that different from 20 minutes to 2 hours or whatever.
But however, we're talking about like a decay, you know, a time decay curve. It's initially very steep, but then flattens out.
Exactly. It is extraordinarily steep because to me, maybe the most important thing about the chicken that we've had, or at least for me consuming it, is eating it fresh. Because when it's fresh, it tastes so much better than it does even 20 minutes after you've had it. Eating fried chicken immediately, and this is more so than I think any food that we've had in this search. In any search.
Well, we haven't been doing takeout that often in these previous searches.
We've done a lot of takeout. Like
a fair amount.
Teriyaki can sit. You don't need teriyaki to be piping hot. The fundamental elements of teriyaki don't change that much. Fried chicken is literally encasing juices inside of an outer shell. And when you get those hot juices coming out, that's when you get these perfect moments. That's when you get the pinnacle element of fried chicken. When it's later, it still tastes good. But the first 10 minutes of fried chicken, well, it's hot for a second. It's got to say hot. That's what it has to say for fried chicken. I think fried chicken travels well. And also, it loses its best form faster than almost any other food we've eaten. Fried chicken is full of complexities.
By the way, dumplings, 100%, are first on. In ramen, those things both travel terribly. We just didn't eat those as takeout.
I don't know if I agree with
that. Because it wasn't a pandemic.
I ate tons of dumplings as takeout. And I think they tasted basically the same at home.
Agree to disagree on that.
Look, is there a better experience
very few dumplings and ramen?
Sitting around Dough Zone with a bunch of people, right? And a big circular table. And you're just like, you feel like a king when you're just like grabbing dumplings. You're just like, give me that. But there's not a better experience than that. But I think taste-wise, I don't think they don't lose their perfect form as quickly as chicken does.
I had Thai food on Saturday night and it reminded me of a Thai dinner that I had had in San Francisco during a Count the Dings podcast weekend. And the experience of just like everybody in the table picking an entree and ordering all of those and splitting them up, that's the thing now I miss the most.
Yep.
Oh, someday.
Okay. So D&E's Famous Fried Chicken.
Yes. So we got the whole fried chicken there.
Got the whole damn bird.
We had to call up to make sure that we could do it because it wasn't available at that point on the website. And that was pretty much it. We did not get anything else. So
we got other items.
I mean, but not
you got mac
not
and
any
cheese,
other chicken items.
Which you then,
well,
in what is now becoming a Pelton Cast theme, something I did not expect to be.
No.
Got to your house with brought in the chicken and the mac and cheese. You were scooping out it for you, and you're going to give me the rest of the mac and cheese. And promptly threw the mac and cheese on the ground.
This one was more my fault than the chicken strips. I'm taking
You're
the
not
blame
a part of my system.
Oh boy.
But that was the only chicken we got, even though they have a variety of chicken options on the menu. They've got a chicken and waffle option, which comes with wings. I think I would prefer that with they have the chicken sandwich, as we mentioned. They have strips available. So pretty much any form of chicken you can think of, you can get it there.
I don't agree with that statement, but okay.
Well, and fried chicken.
Any form of fried chicken. I was going to say, it's a pretty diverse food.
That's a fair point.
I can think of many other ways that chicken could be prepared.
Yes. Fried chicken.
So what did you think?
I thought it was great. I really thought the ambiance of walking in there, I said to myself, it felt, I like going into places and thinking to myself, this is COVID safe. And it felt fairly COVID safe. There was almost nobody in Pioneer Square on a Sunday morning. And I ate it extraordinarily fresh. It was piping hot. Like I took a bite and then had to put it down. It was full of, I want to say, rosemary, very spicy in a way, right? Like not spicy, like it was hot, but had just like tons of flavor to it. The fried had flavor to it. It was crunchy. The chicken on the inside was juicy.
And had its own flavor. Like it was clearly well brined. That's something I don't think we've come across a lot so far in this search.
A really well brined chicken. That's interesting.
Well, just in terms of making sure that the chicken itself has flavor, you're not relying strictly on the breading to provide all the flavor.
Yeah, I really thought it was a very nice experience all around.
So you had, I think you had pretty much everything, but I had a breast, a leg, a thigh, and a wing, I think.
Did you get a chicken strip?
I think that was the thigh. Was basically the strip that was fundamentally boneless.
Interesting.
That's my assumption there.
Okay. So the thigh they basically do is a chicken strip.
That's my guess.
And the chicken tasted totally different. It was actually really fascinating to see how the chicken, I'm going to say ages, how over time the chicken is affected when there's bones versus not bones, seeing it just apples to apples right there. And so I had one strip, which I guess you're saying is a thigh. It wasn't dark though. It was still very white.
I don't know.
And the chicken itself actually tasted totally different in that piece of chicken than it did in the chicken breast, which was pretty fascinating. They both tasted really good though. And I think the thing that stood out to me about the chicken strip was like you were saying, like the brine, the chicken itself actually tasted very good. It wasn't just like, sometimes, you know, chicken can be a little bit bland if you're not relying on the breading.
I thought that was probably my favorite piece of the chicken. I thought the breast was a little greasier than I prefer, but I also don't like particularly greasy chicken. And I know that position probably puts me in the minority. I think a lot of people do like that. Anyways, I mean, the clear takeaway to me here is this is a legit contender for Seattle's best fried chicken.
Wow.
No doubt about it. In fact, it's gotten my highest score thus far of a 92.
Wow. Holy cow. What is your score?
92.
Oh, 92. I was thinking 92 also.
There you go.
I really just thought it was a great experience all around. I don't know what I would have changed about it. You know, the chicken itself.
I would have changed the spilling the mac and cheese. That's what I would have changed about it. Not a reflection at all on DNA.
The only thing that I would have changed about it is I would have sat there and casually enjoyed it on a Sunday morning. It was a beautiful experience. You know, you're going down a Pioneer Square. It's like a wasteland. I love that. And there's like nobody around. It's a beautiful little spot. I couldn't have asked for anything more.
Wow. Okay. Well, this is very exciting. I mean, we've got some strong contenders, some places we're really excited to get back to, and still a lot of strong contenders left on our list.
And again, I do think that the biggest difference is eating it fresh. I think eating chicken fresh, literally piping hot fresh, not fresh 20 minutes later, immediately fresh. I think that is the biggest difference.
All right, so with that in the books, it's time to bring back a segment we haven't had in entirely long, too long here, which is our NBA update.
Hello.
Because with the trade deadline also in the books, wanted to talk a little bit about our Blazers.
There we go.
Who made a big swing at the deadline, not necessarily expected, sending Gary Trent Jr. and Rodney Hood to Toronto for Norman Powell. Tristan is our resident Blazers homer. What's your take on this, Bev?
Well, so, look, my feelings have transformed.
I feel like much of Blazers Nation.
I called you right away on Sunday night, or not on Sunday, on Wednesday night, Thursday night.
Your deadline's on Thursday.
And you were like, Norman Powell's great. And I said to you, well, at least they got Paul Spoljarek and Mike Timlin back. In the moment, seeing that Gary Trent Jr. had been traded, this was the most devastating trade of a young player since Jose Cruz Jr.
I mean, I wish I could think of something off the top of my head to come back at you with, but I can't.
I mean, there just aren't that many trades of young players that you like that much.
Yes.
And then we saw Norman Powell play, and all of a sudden, I'm thinking the Blazers, there's a lane in the Western Conference. Nurk's back. CJ's back. Norman Powell is out there. Rocco spreading the floor, plus MVP candidate Dame Lillard. There is a lane in the Western Conference. Look, the top of the Western Conference is weak, and the Blazers are coming for the top of the Western Conference. This is a stacked roster at this point. You push Ennis to the bench, right? Look at the depth that the Blazers now all of a sudden have. This is a good roster.
Wow, Rocco's up to 38% from three. It's remarkable how much like starting the season slowly has a lingering effect, even when this is why you look at statistics, because it seems in my head that he's still shooting like 30% on threes, but he's actually making 38%.
Kevin Pelton admits he doesn't look at statistics.
I hadn't looked at that specifically. I thought this was interesting because number one, the Blazers and Raptors have very similar fan bases. There's a north-northwest connection here. And it was almost sweet and endearing to see those two fan bases come together online to tell the other group, like, hey, you got a great player that we really love. With all due respect to Rodney Hood, I don't think he was included in that. I think it was pretty much about Norm and Gary Trent Jr. Because the Raptors fans love Norman Powell. And Blazers fans, I think, really had come to enjoy Gary Trent Jr. in his
Gary Trent Jr. No, we love Gary Trent Jr.
Okay. I just didn't want to say love back to back. It felt like I should mix it up a little bit there.
Enjoy? That's passive. And Blazers fans are not passive.
Well, that is certainly true.
We're and not passive about how then, we treat players.
Then as soon as those two sides saw these players in their uniforms, all of a sudden they bought in. Although it was especially weird that their second game on Saturday, I think it was Saturday, was against each other's teams. Very odd. I think Norman Powell at one point lined up with the Raptors, had forgotten that he had been traded to the Blazers.
And the Blazers pulled off the W, just like you expected them to. And the schedule is weak. The West is weak. The Lakers are fading. This Blazers team is... Look,
someday they might even have a positive point differential.
Oh, my God.
you want to hate so much,
but that point differential is based upon a team that is not on the court right now.
It's not unfair.
That's a historical point. CJ is back. Nurk is back. Norman Powell is out there. This is a good Blazers team. You've talked so much shit about the Blazers online and offline, and you're scared to admit that they're the favorites in the Western Conference.
Oh, boy.
Right here on the Fabulous Pelton Cast, will Kevin Pelton admit that the Blazers are the favorites in the Western Conference?
No. I'm probably still picking the Lakers, even if they end up in the play-in tournament.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to write about that this weekend. Anything else in the Blazers?
I can't wait.
Well, we'll probably be checking in with them more regularly here during the second half, the post-deadline portion of the season. But it's time now to check in on another team that we haven't talked about in a while and really haven't talked about, like, just actually them on the field in a long period of time, because it's the return of the season opening edition, the opening day edition of your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
It was 2002 and one of the busiest trade routes in all of baseball, especially while Pat Gillick was in charge, when suddenly a strong gust of wind sent the good ship ever Mariners on a tailspin. There may have been some human or technical errors as well. It flailed violently back and forth and eventually ended up stuck, obstructing the path to the playoffs. It took at least 20 years to unground the vessel, and they tried everything along the way. King Felix, Robinson Cano, Eric Bedard, Nelson Cruz, Cliff Lee, Cranes, dredging, Jose Lopez, but nothing could free the grounded ship until finally there was a little movement and a little more. And Kyle Lewis and Jared Kelenic and other Mariners players. And the playoff ship in the year 2021, after 20 long years and some rule changes, finally broke free and was on its way again, opening up the path for joy and happiness and Din Tai Fung. That's right. All stuck things must come unstuck. And I give you your 2021 Mariners, the team who will right the good ship again.
You really outdid yourself with that one. That is well done. I look forward to, if we do like a season review of hot takes as we do sometime, looking back in October on the references to the ship being stuck in the Suez Canal.
Jose Lopez. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. and seeing what we think of them then. So Thursday, it all gets underway for the Mariners. It'll be the first sporty event in Seattle with actual paying fans since March 2020. The Sounders were the last event, right? The that Saturday night doomed Sounders match against Columbus.
Doomed Sounders match.
Well, like
you're getting paid for this? Paying fans.
As the Mariners host the Giants to open the season, they will be doing
They're hosting an NL team.
Yep.
Wow, not those Giants. The Mariners have been demoted.
There's a real timely Major League 2 reference. Well, speaking of demoted, Jared Kelenic, he's not going to be helping the Mariners get unstuck just yet because he's stuck in Arizona along with Julio Rodriguez, who were sent down and will stay in Arizona and play against minor leaguers rather than being part of the Mariners alternate site group in Seattle as they were last year.
I wonder why that's happening.
Huh. Funny. I think that once he gets like precisely 2 months, I don't know what the number of service days is that he has to not acquire this year. Then he'll be ready. Not now. When Kelenic led the Mariners with a 12.56 OPS in 18 spring training at bats, including
two
home runs.
Are you kidding me? God, I hate this team. I hate the sport of baseball. That's the problem.
It's not the Mariners. It's not them. It's the league.
It's them too.
And this one
the same
is not
league
on
that
them.
They kept Vlad Guerrero Jr. in the minor leagues also.
I'm sure they did.
Just to control the players for as long as possible. God, baseball's the worst. Ugh.
Yeah.
Maybe 100%. We could have some rule changes. Maybe instead of adding more teams to the playoffs and more play-in games, how about if you fix this shit, baseball? Maybe do something to get the players that people are excited to see play into the major leagues. How about
it
that?
It seems like a really simple fix to have. Actually, he ended up with two more at-bats after they officially sent him down. So an 11.40 OPS, which still did lead the team during spring training, two home runs in his 20 at-bats. Julio Rodriguez was fourth on the team in OPS at 984, 313, 421, 563 stat line. Taylor Trammell, also a very strong spring with a 1037 OPS. Is he part of the major league team? I should probably know that, but I don't.
Alan Trammell's son?
Yes.
There we go.
You'll find out when you see Taylor Trammell play, you'll know he is not related.
Oh, really?
Yes.
He's black?
Yes. This is like the time I had never seen Duncan Robinson play when he first transferred to Michigan, and he just popped into my stats at first, and I legitimately thought he was David Robinson's son.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Big Dog. He said Michigan.
No.
So taking a look at some projections for the Mariners for the 2021 season, ESPN, my colleague Bradford Doolittle's projections have them finishing on average 70-92 with 2% playoff odds. Baseball Prospectus's Pecota projections on average 71-91. I couldn't find any playoff odds there. And Fangraphs, the most optimistic that I found, 74-88 on average with 3% playoff odds. So you're telling me there's a chance.
Sometimes there's glitches in all the computers.
This is some serious glitches in this case. But it's going to be interesting. Are you planning to watch opening day?
So I don't want to have a return of a segment of Coach's Corner because I was not chosen to coach baseball. But I do want to report that only three of my 15 children are playing baseball this year in 2021, two of them for the first time ever. And one of them, the middle child, is so cocky about his baseball abilities because he has watched the movie Sandlot.
Fantasy Genius said this in our group chat. And I like, really? It's so hard for me to believe.
He's not the most skilled baseball player, but he talks shit really well. And I think that that's the most important thing.
What specifically did he take from the movie Sandlot?
I think he took the same thing that all the kids took from the movie Sandlot, which was, that's a scary dog. But
wait, did you screen Sandlot for them?
It was on Sunday night.
Okay.
It's more of a dog film to children more than it is a baseball film.
They probably don't really get the Babe Ruth subplot.
George. For me, it's more of a film of explaining what chewing tobacco is.
You explain that the neighbor is also Darth Vader?
I did. Yeah, you know it.
Yeah.
Is also Darth Vader. But there's like a kid who missed a grounder. These are kindergartners. And Marco is like, you probably should have gotten that. Talking shit.
Oh boy.
I also went to baseball. I took Baby's Fantasy Genius to his first ever baseball practice. And let me tell you,
T-ball at this age, at age
he
four.
Has a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And somehow more energy than any of the other children, because you know he hasn't been around little kids that much during a pandemic. Like half of, or what, 20% of his life, maybe even more, has
more
been
than
spent,
basically a quarter at this point,
has been spent in a pandemic. So I have no idea how to compare him to other fucking 4-year-olds or whatever. And I just don't know.
Wait, what don't you know?
He was all over the place, literally just like running. They lined everybody up and they're like, okay, throw the ball as far as you can and then go get it and see if you can beat it. And he's just gone. He threw it and then he kept throwing it and then he kept throwing it. He was just running around all over the place. He's the only child doing this. The other ones were way more reined in. I think Jan was almost embarrassed. No, she was too busy worried about jury duty, but complaining to me about it in the outfield. But so they did a thing where you get up to, everybody lines up, gets up to hit. I'm like, I'm going to hold on to the bat. I don't trust you with a baseball bat. Look, you've seen him. You should not trust him with a baseball bat and a bunch of kids around.
That is correct.
And so I was like, he's the only child who is not trusted with a baseball bat. So I had to give him the bat right before he went up to hit. So he comes around and he's like rounding the bases after hit. And he got to second base and then got into a heated, long conversation about Minecraft with the dad who was playing second base.
What?
And so when the kid who was up hit the ball, they were supposed to move on to the next base. And he was not done talking about Minecraft. He's like deep into it. He's like, and then there's an Ender Dragon and a Nether portal or whatever. And dad's just like, what the fuck? And so the kid who was at the plate hit the ball while he's at second base. And the dad's like, run to third. He's like, no. I'm not done talking to you about Minecraft. So he stood on second base for like another minute, rambling at this man about Minecraft instead of running to third base. Like, that's what he took from baseball practice. I feel like this is all that he learned, was that he found another person to talk to about Minecraft.
Which again, he hasn't had people during the pandemic. He's only had a
he's had us every fucking day of our entire lives. But he found another person who engaged with him on Minecraft even at all, and he was not about to leave second base. That was it. He was there forever.
Whew. Well, that's been a delightful parents' corner, I guess. It's not coaches' corner.
We'll see. You never know. Sometimes I don't expect to be coaching and I just end up coaching.
Unexpected coaching is the best kind. Let's turn our attention to the Sounders, whose full 2021 MLS schedule was announced on Wednesday. It's a home-heavy early schedule for the Sounders, who will play 7 of their first 10 matches at Lumen Field through the month of June. Naturally, that flips at the end of the season, as 7 of their last 10 matches are on the road, which will limit their overlap with the Seahawks home games. MLS decision day is set for November 7th. So, you know, a mere 7 months away from the end of the MLS regular season. The Sounders scrimmaged the Portland Timbers Tuesday at Starfire, drawing 1-1 with a first-string squad that included 2 forwards, Freddie Montero and Will Bruin, and apparently 5 defenders with Brad Smith, Shane O'Neill, Javier Arriaga, Nuhu, and Alex Roldan all starting. Montero got the lone Sounders goal. Then the teams later drew 0-0 in a second game featuring reserves that went 75 minutes. On the front office front, FanSided's MLS Multiplex was the first to report that the Sounders will hire former Real Salt Lake GM Craig Wable as sporting director. Wable was a Spokane native who played at UW and for the Sounders in the USL before beginning an MLS career that spanned 156 appearances with 4 clubs. He later worked for Sounders GM Garth Lagerwey with RSL before replacing him as GM when Lagerwey came to Seattle.
All right.
Then the Sounders introduced a third kit, the Jimi Hendrix kit. The bright accents and psychedelic patterns are a nod to Jimi Hendrix's album covers and memorable onstage style. Jimi's signature stamps the bottom of each jersey, and the neck tape features his handwritten lyrics from his song Straight Ahead. In partnership with Puyallup Tribe's Emerald Queen Casino, proceeds from the first 30 days of sales will be donated to 5 local nonprofits, the Jimi Hendrix Park Foundation, MoPOP, Northwest African American Museum, the Sounders' own Rave Foundation, and Tacoma Public Schools Indian Education Program. Then lastly, U.S. Soccer announced that this year's U.S. Open Cup will eliminate the opening round due to the pandemic and begin play with 16 teams, wow, including 8 from MLS.
They should call it the Not-So-Open Cup this year.
Wow. You wouldn't even go with closed cup. So the 8 teams from MLS will be determined based on the standings after the first 3 weeks of the MLS season. So a lot of pressure now on those first 3 weeks.
So there's going to be 8 MLS teams and then 8 other teams?
Yes, I think it's like 4 from USL1 and 4 from other levels of the U.S. soccer pyramid.
Interesting.
Moving ahead to UW Sports, Husky softball dropped the first 2 games of their series at Arizona State, losing 5-4 on Friday night and 6-1 Saturday afternoon before winning the second game of the Saturday doubleheader 14-7 and then run ruling the Sun Devils on Sunday 11-1. It was an atypically poor outing Friday for Gabby Plain, who suffered her first loss of the season, giving up 4 runs in 5 innings, struck out just 6. Actually, that was a no decision. She did not take the loss. Then Kelly Lynch got roughed up for 5 hits and 4 runs in just an inning plus on Saturday. Brooke Nelson gave up 7 runs in 4 innings in the nightcap, but still got the win thanks to the hot hitting from the Huskies and 3 scoreless innings in relief from Pat Moore. Plain was back in form on Sunday, allowing only 1 run in the 5th and final inning as the Huskies exploded for 11 runs in the first 4 innings, including 4 home runs.
Wow.
So the Huskies, with the split on the road against the number 14 team in the country, who moved up 2 spots based on it, they stayed 6th in the ESPN.com USA Softball Top 25. They are back home this weekend hosting Cal for a 4-game series Thursday through Saturday, I assume, so teams can be back home on Easter Sunday. Bears come in 1-2 in Pac-12 play, having lost 2 of 3 at Oregon State before having their series at UCLA. Versus UCLA, I should say, postponed. Also lost a pair of non-conference games to Stanford. So Cal, probably not one of the powers in the Pac-12 softball.
They're the only one.
There's a couple. There's 1 or 2 in the Conference of Champions.
So now we got to talk about UW men's basketball and the transfer portal. Basically, half the returning scholarship players have now placed their names in the transfer portal, with Marcus Sahonis, Raekwon Battle, Jerron Brooks, and Nate Pryor following Eric Stevenson and signaling their intent to consider a transfer. Pryor was the first on Saturday to announce a new destination. He's headed to New Mexico State. Of those, I would say Sahonis is by far the most surprising, given that he played more than anyone save Stevenson and really looked like the future of the UW program in the backcourt. You'll recall a few weeks ago when we talked about how he was the one silver lining in this dismal UW men's basketball season.
I gave you a look like, what's going on? You gave me a look like, I don't know what's going on.
Well, you've got to say it out loud. It doesn't work in a podcast to give me a look.
It felt like maybe we should have seen this coming a little bit more than we did. The Eric Stevenson entering the transfer portal after one season at UW, especially returning home for that one season, was kind of weird. When it happened, it didn't make a lot of sense naturally, especially because he got playing time. You know, maybe some of the playing time faded throughout the season, and especially maybe even because of poor play, maybe felt like he wouldn't necessarily be part of the roster or a focus of the roster next year. But it sort of could, in hindsight, signal that there was something more coming. Seeing so many guards in particular enter the transfer portal makes you ask the question that I asked you with my eyes, which is, what's going on?
So I don't know. I mean, I think the first thing to know is this is not unique to UW. This is the nature of college basketball.
All guards in every single school in the country have entered the transfer portal.
I mean, the guard thing in particular, I don't know that there was any like organized, like the guards liked Cameron Dollar and he's gone. And like, I don't think it's probably just a coincidence. I think I saw a report that there's like 1,000 players nationally.
God, is there room in the transfer portal?
They're going to have to enlarge it. So that'd be an average of basically 3 per team.
You're going to need a bigger portal.
I mean, transfers are just the nature of college basketball right now, and especially guys who aren't playing. So like, you know, for Battle, Jerron Brooks, Nate Pryor, this completely makes sense. It checks out. It's what you expect to happen. We've already seen, like, Jerron Brooks transferred from USC to UW. It wasn't like an Eric Stevenson situation where that was about the coaching staff and Greg Marshall, who was eventually fired. That was, Jerron Brooks didn't play very much as a freshman at USC. He transferred to UW, came here, didn't play very much. So he's going to go try to find somewhere else where he actually can play minutes. And I think on top of it, like, if you're not playing for a team as bad as the Huskies were this season, like that's the other thing I don't know how much to put on here is like, it was probably a miserable season for just about everyone because of the fact that you're trying to play through a pandemic and all the restrictions on that. And if you're not winning games on top of it, that's an extra miserable season in all likelihood. So the other question I think we're going to have to figure out here is, being that this is the nature of college basketball in 2021, how many transfers are the Huskies going to get? And they've already apparently added one. So Terrell Brown Jr., a Garfield High School product who started his career at Seattle U for 2 years before transferring to Arizona last season, announced his commitment to UW.
Really?
Yeah. So Terrell Brown came off the bench primarily for the Wildcats, but averaged 26 minutes per game. He's a legit point guard who led the Red Hawks in assists per game both of his 2 seasons there. So he fills a need for the Huskies, who didn't have that kind of player, assuming that Quade Green does not plan to come back for a fifth year of eligibility. And I think that, you know, maybe the fact that they were bringing in a point guard, maybe that's a factor in why Marcus Sahonis decides to transfer.
So you think they might have even preferred Terrell Brown over Marcus Sahonis? Maybe they didn't make that explicitly clear to Sahonis, but if he's having the conversation like, hey, Terrell Brown is coming, am I the starting point guard? Maybe the answer wasn't explicitly yes.
Yeah, and maybe he wants to play point guard and not shooting guard, and they see him more off the ball. I mean, there's, you know, 1,000 different things. This is... I mentioned this, I went on the rant about this when we had the Puka Nacua transfer a few weeks ago, and it became clear that that was just a personal family issue for him and his brother Samson, both of whom transferred back home to BYU. It's like, not every transfer says something about the state of the program. Sometimes it's just about the individual.
This is a lot of transfers, but so what you're telling me is basically, this is the future that liberals want, which is...
I mean, it is. It literally is, yes. It's the future that we have espoused, to players to be able to transfer without penalty.
No, and I think that aspect of it is great. Look, I would look for a little bit more for the players.
I didn't say that was the only thing.
It's not the only future that liberals want. It's just a future. So basically what you're telling me is there are two ways that players are going to leave a college basketball team in the future that we live in, which are you either exit via the transfer portal or you're going early to the NBA. If one of those two things isn't happening, or you're a borderline walk-on who just sits on the team the entire year and just gets your degree and leaves.
It's not going to be 100%. Like Quade Green did transfer, so I guess. But, you know, he's going to play his 4 years and then move on. Same with Hamir Wright, who did play 4 years at UW. It does not appear he's going to come back for a fit.
But those players still were a little bit of a... They played most of their careers in a slightly bygone era.
Yes.
If they would have been freshmen now, things might have looked different. So basically,
but Quade Green did transfer. So
what we can anticipate is a college basketball around the country, not just for UW, where players are going to be transferring often.
Yeah. I mean, look, this has already been happening for a long time at a lot of schools. Like you look at this Oregon team that got to the Sweet 16. They started Eugene Omori transfer this year, LJ Figueroa transfer this year, Eric Williams transfer this year.
But let me ask you a question. Is there anything that UW can do on an institutional level to make themselves more desirable to transfers? Do they still have some of the rules that could have been considered draconian at the time that allowed them to not bring in transfers prior?
It definitely seems like it's easier to bring in transfers. I mean, we've seen this on the football side where they added three transfers, including a grad transfer this year. Men's basketball was able to add true transfers last year with Eric Stevenson and Cole Bajima. So it does seem like it's not as much of a limitation for UW as it once was. And it wasn't always the only limitation. Like there were transfers who UW was all prepared to bring in and they just chose to go somewhere else, like Mike Mosier. When he went to, I think that was when he went to Oregon instead.
Basically, UW has to be playing this game, though. They have to be playing the same game that everybody else is playing.
Correct.
Which is, if everybody else is bringing in transfers, they have to make it as easy as possible if you want to win basketball games, if that's the goal.
It's the way to win games at this point is to either manage to find someone who is willing to stick around or to get transfers. And then maybe add in some timely freshmen. And that's who you get Gonzaga's roster, which is actually relatively light on transfer this year, but that's definitely been a big thing for them in years past. Huskies also added a second recruit for the class of 2021 in NBA Africa Academy product, Samuel Ariyibi, a native of Lagos, Nigeria. Ariyibi is a 6'8" small forward who is the MVP of the 2019 Basketball Without Borders Africa tournament in Senegal. A description from that tournament by my ESPN colleague Mike Schmitz called him all over the place defensively, attacking aggressively off the bounce, creating for others, a big time competitor.
Vacationed in Ithaca over the summers.
Yeah, unclear his connection to upstate New York. And whatever the geography of upstate New York may be.
Okay, so we shouldn't panic about this though.
I mean, we should panic about the fact that the team is 5 and, you know, whatever the record was last year. Like it's not like it's a good situation for UW, especially if we're entering a make or break season for Mike Hopkins. And the other thing we didn't mention is that some more change to the coaching staff, several reports that Dave Rice will not be returning in addition to Cameron Dollar's decision to step away. So a couple of open spots on the coaching staff for Mike Hopkins to fill ahead of this, again, extremely crucial season to his future at UW.
All right.
UW football news in his final game at Kennedy Catholic at Highland Memorial Stadium. Sam Heward surpassed Brett Rypien to become the Washington State leader in career passing yards. He was told reporters postgame that he was set to enroll at UW on Monday for the start of spring quarter, paving the way for him to participate in spring practice as one of three quarterbacks on the UW roster, along with returning starter Dylan Morris and transfer Patrick O'Brien. God,
I don't take a second, dude. Good God. He just played a short football season at Kennedy and is enrolling.
I mean, he's not playing the full season. They still have, I believe, 3 games left.
Well, still, I mean, I guess that's even more impressive that he set the Washington State record for passing yards and didn't even play a full senior season. But
he played 40 games as a senior.
Good God. Just, I think about this for a 17, 18-year-old and just like, just chill for a minute. Jesus.
I mean, this is the nature of big-time college football now is, you know, if you want to have a chance to start as a freshman, you kind of have to come in early and be part of spring practice. So I don't know if that system is good for athletes because it's probably different in normal years because I don't know how much of the traditional senior year experience Sam Heward was going to get at Kennedy Catholic if he had continued attending classes there because it's a pandemic. I don't think that Kennedy is doing classes on campus as yet. I haven't noticed that when I've driven past to go to Fred Meyer. So.
Is UW in person for any campus or for any classes?
I don't think so, but I don't know. Got off the top of my head.
You have to assume that Dylan Morris is still he's the incumbent starter. And I think you have to assume that you're going into this into the season, assuming that Dylan Morris will be the starter, but wouldn't be shocked if Sam Heward were to unseat him.
Or, you know, maybe if Dylan Morris starts the season as a starter, but Sam Heward plays at some point, it's all possible. But one thing I do think, like, we need to be careful not to overburden Sam Heward with expectations because that's the worst thing that you can do to someone that young.
Also the burnout level for players. It's just like there's so much more to this, just like nonstop football between these things. But he'll probably have a year at least, potentially even multiple years. He'll probably transfer. I don't know.
I think Dylan Morris will probably end up transferring is my bet is on that. But
wow.
We'll see.
Dylan Morris played really well last year.
He did, but Sam Heward is like, I don't know. We'd have to look at this. He is probably one of the best prospects the Huskies have ever brought in at quarterback.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think so.
Okay. So this could be a Trevor Lawrence type situation where there's a very solid quarterback, but he's just
you know what it could be?
A Jacob Eason type
situation. Jacob Eason situation, yes.
But where there's a very solid quarterback ahead of him, but he's just so good that you have to start him.
It's possible. Again, I don't want to say that should be our expectation for Sam Heward. And if he doesn't do that, we should be disappointed because that's ridiculous. Or that Sam Heward, like, I think there was a comment in the Seattle Times, this thing about like giving hope for the program. And it's like, my dudes, we were in the Rose Bowl 2 years ago. Like, what the hell?
For the program.
It's not like we were, it's like the 0-12 season.
Would have been in the Pac-12 championship game this year without a COVID outbreak.
I mean, that would have been a little dubious, but yes.
I mean, I guess.
It's not like the program is struggling right now. And that's why I don't get the weird sense of negativity about UW football. I think, like, the problem here is there have been too few games and too much time for everything that is not games in college football. And everything that is not games in college football tends to be really irrational. Not that the games portion of it is rational, but when all you can talk about is recruiting and transfers, shit gets really irrational.
Who is talking at this?
UW fans, boosters.
But no, the headline of giving hope to the program.
I feel like that was in the Seattle Times story, or at least alluded to.
Is Sam Heward, is he a righty or lefty?
He's a lefty.
Hell yeah, there we go.
Very unusual.
Taking after his uncle, handing the ball off. Pound that rock, Sam Heward.
Okay, the headline is Hope Giver. Kennedy Catholic quarterback Sam Heward sets state passing record 2 days before beginning classes at UW. Oh, and the first line of the story, unfortunately, is Sam Heward is a hope giver. It's like, where's the lack of hope?
It's also just such a weird thing to say.
They lost one game last season. Granted, they only played four. They were all at home.
Hope giver? What a weird way to describe a human being.
I mean, I think that was just the description by his coach.
He's
so it's not
giver.
I can certainly understand why he gave you a lot of hope as a Kennedy Catholic fan.
Not anymore. This is not playing half of his senior year. Hope is lost.
Oh, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Let's wrap up talking about the Seahawks, where we've got a lot of news. Let's start with in something I predicted last week would not happen. The re-signing of defensive end Carlos Dunlap on a two-year deal up to $14.25 million with $8.25 million guaranteed. And this seems like a great deal for the Seahawks.
Absolutely.
Dynamite drop-in money.
excited to have Carlos Dunlap back. I don't know what else there is beyond that.
I mean, just it seems like a good price given where the market fell. You know, we talked last week about how he kind of lasted later onto the market, and that did seem to be an indication that the big kind of defensive end money that I'm sure he was hoping for wasn't out there. So,
and he was great for the Seahawks last year, made a legit impact when he joined the team. I mean, I don't know if this was, there were probably a lot of factors at bay, including regression to the mean. But by the time Carlos Dunlap was playing regularly for the Seahawks, their defense was significantly better.
I will say, I think that what we saw last week, where first they brought back Benson Mayoa, signed Kerry Hyder, and then re-signed Dunlap, it's an example of a classic Seahawks strategy of fighting the last war and making sure that whatever went wrong last season, no matter the cost, it is not going to go wrong this season. And so therefore that Pete Carroll's analysis is what went wrong last year was not having enough quality pass rushers at the start of the season.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that's Pete Carroll's assessment of every single season.
No, sometimes it's they didn't run the ball well enough, and then they draft a running back in the first round.
Think about how often and how many off seasons they've brought in a number of pass rushers. I think it's more about they love, and I don't know if Carlos Dunlap is this necessarily, they love a B-tier pass rusher. If there's one thing that we know about the Seahawks, it's that they want to recreate Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett again. And they will do anything they can to recreate that success. They had that success with those players, and they want to recreate that success. And the way that they view doing that is going out and getting a number of these later pass rushers. I think that they were a unique scenario, Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett, that they were able to get low budget, very, very good pass rushers. But I'm not saying Carlos Dunlap doesn't reach those heights. I think this is a very good deal. I think the deal that we ended up seeing for Kerry Hyder was a very good deal. So they should be signing these players. Like these are good contracts that the Seahawks are signing this offseason.
Yeah, I like the Hyder deal much more, seeing the actual structure of it. And one thing that I think became clear, so to make room for re-signing Carlos Dunlap, the team also waived Jaron Reed, which had to deal with the $6 million cap hit remaining, or $5 million cap hit remaining from his bonus from last year, but saved $8.25 million in non-guaranteed salary before Jaron Reed ended up signing with the Kansas City Chiefs after he was unable to come to terms on a renegotiation of that contract. And so,
clearing the way for Puna Ford.
But also, I think one of the things that I take away from this is the Seahawks probably see Kerry Hyder as someone that they can play at defensive end on early downs, and then as a pass rushing defensive tackle on later downs, perhaps alongside Puna Ford.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They remember when they signed Michael Bennett. And
they are so well aware of when they signed Michael Bennett. And then a classic Seahawks move to get the band back together at defensive tackle. After one season sort of in Jacksonville, because of the fact that he didn't end up playing there, he sat out the season as a COVID opt-out, they brought back Al Woods as a lower cost option there. And, kind of between Al Woods and Kerry Hyder, end up paying them something similar to what they were going to pay Jaron Reed previously.
Some other re-signings on the offensive line. They re-signed Jordan Simmons to a one-year deal around the minimum, although with some upside in terms of incentives. And then also backup tackle Cedric Ogbuehi got a one-year deal similar to the one he got last year for about $2 million, a little more than $2 million, but slightly smaller cap hit with avoidable year. So we learned a little about how the Seahawks are going to make room under the salary cap for all these additions. As expected, they reworked newcomer guard Gabe Jackson's contract to a three-year $22.6 million deal, giving him a $9 million signing bonus and guaranteeing an additional $7 million in salary for 2021 and 2022, but in the process reducing his cap number this season from $9.6 million he had been set to count to just $4.1 million.
What do we think of this deal?
It seems reasonable. Like, you know, it's basically a two-year $16 million deal with a $6.5 million option for 2023. So, yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. Like, they weren't going to trade a draft pick for Gabe Jackson and have him end up counting at $9.6 million in salary. That was never going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, they're definitely anticipating that Gabe Jackson is going to be an anchor of this offensive line, which I don't think is unfair. You know, they went out. I don't know if Gabe Jackson is enough to make Russell Wilson happy. I would probably venture to guess that Gabe Jackson is not enough to make Russell Wilson happy, but it's something at the very least. You know, they didn't do absolutely nothing on the offensive line, and the chances of him being, you know, the PFF number aside, a better starter than Mike Iupati last year, I think is still pretty high.
On the more positive note, ESPN's piece on this today noted that he was top 20 in terms of pass block win rate among guards last season. So that's very positive.
Yeah. I'm feeling fairly good about this offensive line in general with the addition of Gabe Jackson.
And I would say I'm feeling with Dunlap's return, I'm feeling more optimistic about the offseason in general. I think I've upgraded it from fine to solid.
Wow. We have reached the level of solid. There we go.
I'm thinking of this like every time Jim Cramer moved up the stock and on Arrested Development and they threw a party.
Uh-huh. The Seahawks offseason is a don't buy.
Yeah, don't buy. RIP the late great Jessica Walter, by the way.
There just wasn't a lot of flexibility for the Seahawks here in this offseason. They have basically no draft picks. They had very, very little money. It was going to be a shuffling no matter what. And what they've done is they brought back Carlos Dunlap, which I think was a wise decision. And they added the Gerald Everett contract is the one to me that I'm still like, I think that is the one that we are most likely to regret. Akella with trading Shaquille Griffin for Akella Witherspoon. We'll see. Richard Sherman still hasn't signed, right?
He still has not signed and seems increasingly eager to encourage any suitor who might be willing to sign him.
Really?
I mean, him talking about being so open to a return to the Seahawks, it definitely feels like, come on, please come and get me.
Fucking do it, Pete. That's you want to upgrade from a solid to a great offseason. Bring in Richard Sherman. I don't even care. I've got a Richard Sherman. What are you going to give me a take about this?
My take is that they should wait here. Because the downside of this offseason is that they have not managed to get a compensatory pick for losing Shaquille Griffin. And I would not want to blow that chance on signing Richard Sherman now. Whereas, you know, if you wait, I don't know what the date is off the top of my head, but later in the offseason, you could sign him and not have him count.
Okay, so that's when the Seahawks signed Sherm.
Especially because, like, San Francisco, they're only netting seventh round comp picks at this point, but they're netting three. The Rams are currently netting five, and the Cardinals three, according to the projections at overthecap.com. So the other teams in the NFC West are making up for the fact that they've traded all of their future for sure, which, by the way, we haven't talked about the 49ers yet and their trade. They're making up for some of the, in terms of volume, for some of the picks they lost, and the Seahawks are not. So I would like to see them net a comp pick if KJ Wright ends up signing elsewhere.
Okay. But let's not talk about KJ Wright signing elsewhere. Are you feeling like that's more and more likely, exceedingly likely?
I mean, the Seahawks are still in pretty tough situation in terms of cap space right now, and they haven't signed KJ Wright yet. So I'm upgrading my whole grading of the Seahawks offseason. I'm downgrading my rating of the chances of them re-signing KJ Wright.
How does that affect? I really felt like for much of last season, KJ Wright was one of the best defensive players on the field.
Agreed. But they also drafted an off-ball linebacker in the first round last year, and they probably want him to play.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, he's reportedly negotiated somewhat with the Cowboys. That's a possibility. Or he'd be reunited with Dan Quinn, even though they have apparently a ton of linebackers, it appears. So.
Okay, so you're telling me right now you wouldn't say that the Blazers are going to come out of the West. But you're telling me right now, once we get past clock pick deadline period, the Seahawks will sign Richard Sherman.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying I will full-throatedly endorse signing Richard Sherman as soon as he does not count in terms of comp picks.
It's the best offseason they've had since the Bennett Averill year if they bring back Sherm.
It'd be exciting. I mean, everyone would feel good about that.
I'll go that far. But you do kind of that's the one place I think the Everett contract and the Akello Witherspoon, we just don't know whether he'll be good enough to replace Shaquille Griffin. If you bring in somebody like Richard Sherman, the combination of all of those players, now all of a sudden we're talking. And I do think the Seahawks, I don't mean to excuse this, but the Seahawks will always spend more on the defensive line than they will in the secondary. It's probably wiser to spend more in the secondary than in the defensive line, but that's just not the world that we live in right now. And so with this coach and with this front office, that's going to be the case. It doesn't surprise me that we've seen the re-signing of Carlos Dunlap and the signing of Kerry Hyder, but they focused on that position and bringing Benson Mayoa back in a place where they weren't willing to bring KJ Wright back and they weren't willing to bring Shaquille Griffin back.
Well, again, I wouldn't say it's 100% that KJ Wright's out the door. Now, Quentin Dunbar is another possibility. There was a report on Tuesday from Ian Rappaport of NFL Network that he will visit Arizona and Detroit next week. So we'll see what happens there. Those are probably him and KJ Wright are probably the two most notable Seahawks free agents left out there. You've also got Bruce Irvin, although it seems like maybe there's room for him as a linebacker if KJ Wright walks, but certainly not in the defensive end rotation.
Bruce Irvin retired.
Wait, did he?
Yeah, he posted on Twitter. He said it's time to go.
Oh, I missed this entirely. Wow. You didn't tell me to put this in the toasts?
I didn't really remember it until right now.
Did Bruce Irvin retire? Bruce Irvin sends out cryptic tweet possibly hinting at retirement. I missed this story entirely, but I'm not ready to take him off the list yet. The Geno Smith, we'll see what they do as far as a backup to Russell Wilson. That's another one I think you could see addressed later in the offseason. The other thing I would not want them to sign right now, but would want them to sign after the comp pick deadline is some veteran wide receiver.
You would like them to sign a veteran wide receiver.
Yeah, I don't think that's a position you should invest resources in at this point, but someone who's available out there in June, sure, by all means.
Great. All right.
That's my take, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, give me a minimum veteran wide receiver.
Do you want me to look up a list of free agent wide receivers?
No. Let's talk about the 49ers.
Oh, boy. Like every team in the NFC West except the Cardinals is out multiple first round picks. Like there's no other team in the league that is out multiple first round picks except the teams in the NFC West. It's so bizarre.
It's not bizarre. It's an arms race. And I think it's because of the Seahawks and their sustained success that so many other teams, but you have, I mean, how many divisions are there where three different teams have been to the Super Bowl in the last 10 years?
I mean, I'd have to look that up. There can't be many.
Or the NFC South, where the Saints didn't go, right?
Not within the last 10. I guess that might have been within the last 10 years.
But the Seahawks have been so good, and there have been so many other good teams in the NFC West that it's an arms race between all the teams. You know, every team feels like they need to go for it right now. We're in Russell Wilson's prime. We've got the Rams, who are fully all in right in this very moment. I see why the Niners are doing this, but I feel like the Niners' timeline is... I think that Niners fans, they took a victory lap with this trade or whatever. This is not a win now move per se.
Yes, like, I would agree with that.
Whomever they draft, it could be a win in 2 years move or a win in 3 years move, but like, you're not going to draft a player with the third pick in the draft and have them be your starting quarterback going to the Super Bowl in the NFC in this moment. Like, I don't believe that whomever they draft.
They're telling people that they're not planning to play this player this year.
Well,
we'll see whether that's true or not, but that's what they're telling people.
Duff Mann says a lot of things. How many quarterbacks who've been drafted in the top? I mean, Mahomes is honestly like an outlier because he didn't play.
He is,
but
yes.
If you're drafting a quarterback in the top,
the Saints, by the even though the Saints have not been since for a while, the NFC South still has had teams make it in the past 6 years because Tampa Bay, Carolina, and Atlanta all have made it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's funny. It's like, you know, Carolina, obviously they aren't what they were, but the quarterback, if the 49ers draft a quarterback, which you don't trade for the number three pick in the draft to not draft a quarterback. If the 49ers draft a quarterback, that quarterback will be starting by the second half of this NFL season.
I wouldn't guarantee that, but the history is what it is, that most picks quarterback drafted in the first round start at some point as rookies.
It would be a pretty extreme outlier in recent memory to draft a quarterback that high and sit them. In fact, I wouldn't be shocked if Jimmy G wasn't on the team by the time the season started.
It's possible. Lots of things are possible for the 49ers now.
So the reality is I don't think that the Niners are a contender this upcoming season. I still think the NFC West contenders are Seattle, LA, and Arizona, which this is the other reality is that
I don't know. I don't agree with that. I mean, even if there's a rookie quarterback, like the rookie quarterback isn't going to be that much worse than Nick Mullins and CJ Beathard. And the rest of the roster is going to be much healthier than it was last year in all likelihood.
Okay. If I had to put percentage chances of winning the division, I think it's pretty even between the Rams, the Cardinals, and the Seahawks. And I think that the Niners are lower.
I am not as high at the Cardinals as you are.
Really?
Higher on the Niners. Yeah.
Really? If you had to, in this moment, March 30th, 2021, percentage chances up to 100 of winning the NFC West, let's hear it.
30% Rams, 25%, maybe like 35% Rams. And then like around 21%, like 22% for the Seahawks and 49ers and whatever's left for the Cardinals. I mean, I'd put them all very close to a quarter, I think.
I think it's like 27% for the Rams, Cardinals, and Seahawks.
And a solid 19% for the Niners.
Maybe a little bit. I think it's actually a little bit less for the Niners. But I mean, the Cardinals are going to have another year of Kyler, plus they're adding JJ Watt. Like, what else do you want from them?
It occurs to me now that in my actually doing the math in my head that doing 22% apiece for the 49ers and the Seahawks puts the Cardinals at 21% for me. So I may as well have just made them all the same at that point.
But I do think that this move for the Niners is it's not a long-term move necessarily because they're losing a little bit of draft capital, but it means that they're kind of targeting the impact date for the Niners is more like 2023.
Which makes sense because it's on the timeline of some of their, you know, young players. Like, this is not a generally old team.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting, and I mean, it's obviously anytime you trade up, and give up that many first round picks, it's a huge gamble. And you're betting on you're going to find the right quarterback. If that quarterback is just okay, then it's a terrible trade.
The thing that I don't understand, so they were at the 12th pick, right?
Yes.
And who are the quarterbacks? Obviously, there's Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, Trey Lance, Mac Jones. That's four. Is there a fifth one? Zach Wilson is the fifth one. Is the anticipation that none of those quarterbacks would have made it to pick 12?
I think so.
It feels a little bit to me of they fell in love with somebody and felt like they had to go up and get him, which I think is the wrong way to approach the draft.
I just don't know which that somebody is.
It doesn't matter who that somebody is, though. If that somebody is not, it's not Trevor Lawrence, obviously. And beyond that, I think it's a real crapshoot of everybody else. Could they have on draft day moved up to pick 8 and not given up as much and gotten Zach Wilson or whatever? I think that that's the issue here.
The thought is Zach Wilson's going to go in the top 2.
Or could they have moved up to pick 8 and gotten Trey Lance or whatever? Or Mac Jones, that falling in love with any individual player or saying that you have to get to a place to get a player is the wrong way to approach it. And I think that's the issue, is that the NFL draft is unpredictable. The only thing that you can control is having a number of picks, and they've lost control getting a number of picks. You can control drafting a quarterback, and I think drafting a quarterback is a good decision. However, they're investing in a single quarterback rather than multiple quarterbacks.
I mean, multiple quarterbacks is a tough way to do it, but yes, this is all true. Quarterback and multiple other players.
Yeah.
So.
But also, that they're basically saying when they traded up to draft this player at number 3, they're probably not going to move on from that quarterback if he doesn't have, let's say that it's Mac Jones and he starts 8 games and is average or whatever. The likelihood is he probably will never get better than average, and they probably will be committed to him for a number of years.
But enough about Jimmy G.
That's Super Bowl participant Jimmy G to you.
Oh, wow. Super Bowl. I mean, he was a participant in New England.
Multiple Super Bowl participants.
Super Bowl starter sounds better, at least.
No, I think participant sounds more right for what Jimmy G did.
Super Bowl guy who handed off repeatedly.
It is interesting, though, and I think there's probably an element of this, of you hate the getting too cute phrase. Both the Rams and the 49ers had quarterbacks who took them to Super Bowls within the last 3 seasons and have now moved on. The Niners haven't moved on from Jimmy G yet, but could move on from those quarterbacks.
They've invested in alternative quarterbacks. And alternative quarterbacks actually seems like a fascinating thing. What if we just played a running back?
It's an alternative quarterback. Broncos might have started an alternative quarterback for a game last year.
it did not go super great.
Don't invest in alternative quarterbacks.
No, the Saints have tried an alternative quarterback with some decent results.
Somehow worked. But I do think there's an element of there's a feeling in the front office that it's like, if they just get the right quarterback, then everything will be perfect. And I think diminishing some of what Jared Goff and Jimmy G did for those teams and leading them to the Super Bowl. And I'm skeptical whether the alternative is going to be as good as what they had.
I think it's... Yeah,
it's not to say that Jared Goff is not better than that Matthew Stafford is not better than Jared Goff, but is Matthew Stafford better than Jared Goff plus the money plus the picks?
Yes, I think then that's the appropriate way to think about it. That's how I would do it if I were doing the trade grades, and as my colleague Bill Barnwell does, and our buddy friend of the pod, third Bolton brother Sheil Kapadia does doing his grades. So
these quarterbacks still led you to fucking Super Bowls, like. There's a bit of a grass is greener perspective. Maybe Pete Carroll has it too.
You know what's greener for the NFL?
What is that?
Adding a 17th game to the schedule.
There we go.
Which became official on Tuesday. The Seahawks extra game will be at Pittsburgh. And one thing I did not realize until today is that all NFC teams will play 9 road games this season before alternating next year and going forward. So that basically the logic from the NFL being that you're on a level playing field with everyone you're competing with a playoff berth with in your same conference. Huh. So that's something. The schedule will continue to start the Sunday after Labor Day and run an extra week, pushing the Super Bowl back to February 13th. You seem perplexed by this. Again, not good audio, podcast audio for you to just make faces at me.
I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it from being a human being who lives in Seattle on the first week in January. Am I going to be happy to have that extra week of football into February 13th? Is not, it's later. It's a week later.
I mean, I had to look it up to make sure that the NBA All-Star, it didn't like conflict with when the NBA All-Star game was scheduled, which it doesn't.
I'm sure that they looked that up. I'm sure that the NFL thought of this before you did.
The NFL does not care whether they conflict with the NBA All-Star game. The conflict is all on the other side of that coin. People are not going to not watch the Super Bowl because of the NBA All-Star game, with all due respect to the league I cover.
But do we need an extra, from a viewing perspective, do we need an extra week in January? An extra regular season week in January? Because you're pretty fucking...
Need is not part of this. But this is the your scientists were so busy figuring out whether they could. They never thought whether they should.
I'm just saying, ideal scenario. Let's say that a 17th week is happening. Ideal scenario as a fan, I think you move it up.
I disagree, because January, we know, is a miserable month. Football is the only thing that gets you through January. So having one extra week of January covered by football, whereas, you know, it's either the last week of January.
It's one extra week of February that's covered by football. Because January was covered by football no matter what.
I think the last weekend of January sometimes was the bye week between the Super Bowl and the championship games. And also, I don't know if you're aware of this, sometimes your team doesn't make the playoffs.
But you still pay attention to football.
It's more fun if your team is involved.
Yeah, I guess it does give you more...
I mean, this...
More to pay attention to.
This means the Seahawks... first round loss next year wouldn't be until January 16th.
Yeah, through the cold, depressing winter, it gives you a little bit more to pay attention to. But like, I feel like we're going to have some, there'll be like, week 17 is always kind of brutal. There's like one game that you're excited about, and beyond that, I think there might be two kind of brutal weeks now.
It's definitely possible.
We might have week 17 and week 18 where it's just like, it feels gross. You're just like, we're done. Let's just get to the fucking playoffs.
It's the same thing people think listening to this podcast at the end every week.
Do you disagree with this though?
Not totally.
The excitement for football by the time you don't want to lose Labor Day. I don't know. It's tough. Labor Day screws things up a lot, but college football doesn't care.
they sure don't.
So I don't know. We'll see.
The motto of this podcast. On that note.
We'll see. Your college football doesn't care.
We'll see. Could be either though. Good point.
College football does not care.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.